Today is Monday, May 4th, and it's time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I'm going to be reading to you today. We're going to start with the weather and then go to our mini editorial and then read stories of local interest. So let's begin with what's going on outside. Yesterday was a magnificent day. A little bit cooler today with periods of rain, high of 59, low tonight of 47. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, breezy and pleasant, high of 68. On Wednesday, sun and some clouds, high of 63. Then some rain on Thursday, cooler with a thunderstorm possible, high of 58. And on Friday, mostly sunny and cool, high of 62. Okay, our mini editorial today is brought to us by David Adkins of Sioux City. For 3 years, President Trump was criticized for not listening to the experts. While he listened to the experts and it has resulted in a pandemic of panic, that may well destroy more lives than the Wuhan virus. This is the opinion of David Adkins of Sioux City. Now let's turn to today's front page story. It is called Facing Facts. Siouxlanders let masks show their personality during the pandemic. And there are 9 pictures of different people from Siouxland with their masks on. And all different kinds of masks, whether it's a medical mask or if it is a homemade mask, shows all different kinds of patterns and different styles. In Sioux City, COVID-19 masks have a purpose of keeping us and the people we come in contact with safe from the novel coronavirus. And for the most part, that's been the case. Many masks are generally blue or white, and let's face it, a bit humdrum. However, we're beginning to see decidedly fashion-forward COVID-19 masks around Siouxland. A few masks make tentative steps outside the strictly white or off-white shades. Who said masks can't be red, blue, or even black? Other masks boast spring-like designs with flowers or butterflies. Can't wait to go boating? A COVID-19 mask adorned with teeny tiny anchors might make you feel shipshape. Want to go with the Peter Max or Jackson Pollock look? We've seen a few masks that boast either psychedelic design or splotchy pop art. Cat lovers can find masks to announce their fondness for the felines. We also imagine we'll be seeing similar masks for the friends of Fido. Even more shocking are masks that can be considered a form of branding. For instance, a COVID-19 sucks, S-U-X, mask is a way to pay lighthearted kudos to Sioux City. SITP30 mask can give you a chance to say happy birthday to Siouxland's longest-running summer festival, while the University of Nebraska Cornhuskers mask has the potential to draw either cheers or jeers. Whether you like masks that are tidy whities or masks that show off a bit of panache, we might as well get used to wearing them. After all, you shouldn't consider leaving your house with a mask that will keep you both... Shouldn't you consider... leaving your house with a mask that will keep you both safe as well as fashionable during the pandemic? In Woodbury County, more than 1 in 100 have or have had COVID-19. 1,158 of Woodbury County's estimated 103,000 residents have tested positive for the coronavirus to date, a figure equal to more than 1 in 100. Dakota County, meanwhile, has a population estimated at 20,000, and some 980 recorded COVID infections as of Sunday. That's the equivalent of nearly 1 infection for every 20 residents of the county. Not all have an active infection, as 256 of the Woodbury County's total, or about 22%, are considered to have recovered from their infection, according to data from the Siouxland District Health Department. The department recorded 44 new cases on Sunday, 51 in the people in the county are hospitalized with the virus. The total of 3,466 tests have been completed in Woodbury County, with a positive rate of 33%. The Dakota County Health Department, which recorded an additional 8 cases on Sunday, has not disclosed the number of recoveries. The county is considered by the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services to be the second most impacted in Nebraska, only behind Hall County. Each of the counties have seen 2 deaths attributed to the virus. Siouxland District Health on Friday signaled that a number of confirmed cases in Woodbury County is probably going to continue going up. The department wrote in a statement that many of the county's infections began outside the county and the state, and that increased testing will mean more reported infections. Data from Region 3 of Iowa's Regional Medical Coordination Center, which represents Northwest Iowa, indicates that 33 people in the region are in the ICU with the virus, while 25 are on ventilators. The virus tally in other counties in Northwest Iowa and Southeast South Dakota have crept up slowly, but none of them have reached levels comparable to Woodbury or Dakota County. Crawford County, which has the highest tally outside the Sioux City metro area, has recorded 51 cases, while Union County has 31, Yankton County 28, and Plymouth County 23. Other counties in the area have fewer than 20. Statewide, Iowa's COVID-19 tally jumped to 9,169 on Sunday, while the death toll rose to 184. Approximately 36% of Iowa's cases have recovered. Some 53,000 plus tests for the virus have been completed in Iowa, according to the state's Department of Public Health. South Dakota remains the least impacted of the tri-states in terms of the absolute number of cases, though it is comparable to the other 3 on a per capita basis. Minnehaha County accounts for 81% of the state's case total. A total of 2,631 people have tested positive for the virus in South Dakota, but only 811 of them are considered to have active infections. The state's death toll stands at 21. Nebraska stands at 5,659 total cases, according to the Department of Health, and 78 people have died. It's unclear how many have recovered. Dakota County takes up wind farms. The county considers a moratorium on wind farms. In Dakota City, wind energy developers have not approached Dakota County in the past about building wind farms there, county leaders say. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners today will consider a resolution that would keep wind farms out of the county for the foreseeable future. On the agenda for the board's meeting is a moratorium that would prohibit all applications, installations, and projects involving wind energy systems until such a time that the board has amended regulations in place to ensure the protection of the public health, safety, and welfare of Dakota County citizens. The board meeting is scheduled for 1 p.m. in the Dakota County Courthouse. It is not available to view or hear via video streaming or teleconference. The subject of the moratorium arose earlier this year as the county amended its zoning ordinances pertaining to wind energy systems. The board has been doing a little homework on wind energy, said Martin Hohenstein, the board chairperson. We're gathering information to see if it's the right decision for Dakota County at this time. Commissioners approved the amended zoning regulations on April 6th. The proposed moratorium's language indicates that the board deemed it necessary to impose a moratorium after considering public information provided during public hearings on the zoning amendments. Joe O'Neill, the administrator of the Dakota County Joint Planning Commission, said the previous regulations had become outdated and county planners wanted new rules to address the increasing size of wind turbines and other changes in the industry. He said the new regulations, developed after studying other counties' zoning laws, would enable wind energy development in Dakota County without applying crippling restrictions. We don't want to totally shut them out, said O'Neill. A moratorium, however, would shut them out. Josh Moaning, director of the New Power Nebraska, a renewable energy development organization that promotes and develops wind energy projects, said he hadn't heard about Dakota County's proposed moratorium. If it passed, it would cost the county the increased property tax revenue, job opportunities, and economic growth he said that a wind energy project can bring to an area. It would be unfortunate if Dakota County would slam the door shut on opportunities for their own residents, Moning said. Moning said he was aware of only one Nebraska county in the past 3 years that has adopted a wind farm moratorium, though others have pushed for zoning rules that would have made wind farm development impossible. After Stanton County passed its moratorium, Moning said wind energy developers took their plans to neighboring counties instead. Dakota County's neighbors already are on board with wind energy. A $430 million 101 turbine Rattlesnake Creek wind farm in Dixon County began operation in late 2018. It does surprise me that Dakota County is considering a moratorium, given that South Sioux City has been very aggressive in adapting the use of renewable energy, Moing said. Lance Hedquist, the city manager of South Sioux City, the county's largest city, said one-third of the municipality's electricity is bought from wind energy sources and is cheaper than solar, coal, or oil energy. He wondered why a moratorium was requested. We are concerned with the proposed moratorium, Hedquist said in a message emailed Friday after the Board of Commissioners meeting agenda was released. Dakota City resident Marcy Broyhill favors the moratorium, saying that people are led to believe wind energy will save the planet, but they don't know the whole story about what she calls industrial wind. Broyhill referred to a number of books, studies, and documentaries she said show the wind energy industry isn't as promising as supporters say. Broyhill talked about deceptive negotiation tactics when companies seek access to landowners' property. She also doesn't consider wind farms too environmentally friendly, given the tons of concrete and steel required for their construction and the fossil fuels burned by trucks to transport and build the turbines. There's just a lot of unanswered questions about industrial wind that is ignored, Broyhill said. If you weigh the facts, you will find out that it is better to be without industrial wind. Hohenstein said county commissioners have spoken with other counties that have considered moratoriums or passed other restrictions. He said Dakota County leaders are not opposed to the wind energy industry. There's no particular board member that's against wind energy, he said. Okay, we'll continue on with an article that says surgical masks put healthcare workers at risk. With medical supplies in high demand, federal authorities say health workers can wear surgical masks for protection while treating COVID-19 patients. But growing evidence suggests the practice is putting workers in jeopardy. The CDC recently said lower-grade surgical masks are acceptable alternatives to N95 masks unless workers are performing an intubation or another procedure on a COVID patient that could unleash a high volume of virus particles. But scholars, nonprofit leaders, and former regulators in the specialized field of occupational safety say relying on surgical masks, which are considerably less protective than the N95 respirators, is almost certainly fueling illness among frontline health workers, who likely make up about 11% of all known COVID cases. There is no doubt in my mind that it's one of the reasons that so many healthcare workers are getting sick and many are dying, said Jonathan Rosen, a health and safety expert who advises unions, states, and the federal government. As of April 23rd, more than 21,000 healthcare workers had gotten the coronavirus, according to a House Education and Labor Committee staffer briefed by the CDC. The CDC's advice contrasts with another CDC webpage that says a surgical mask does not provide the wearer with a reliable level of protection from inhaling smaller airborne particles and is not considered respiratory protection. Simply put, in worker safety, a surgical mask is not PPE or personal protective equipment, said Amber Mitchell, president and executive director of the International Safety Center and immediate past chair of the Occupational Health and Safety section of the American Public Health Association. The allowance for surgical masks has made more sense when scientists initially thought the virus was spread by large droplets, but a growing body of research shows it's spread by minuscule viral particles that can linger in the air for as long as 16 hours. A properly fitted N95 mask will block 95% of tiny air particles, down to 3/10 of a micron in diameter, which is the hardest to catch, from reaching the wearer's face. But surgical masks designed to protect patients from a surgeon's respiratory droplets are not as effective at blocking particles smaller than 100 microns, according to mask maker 3M. Iowa reports 528 new virus cases. Overall number is declining, but the rate increases. State health officials Sunday announced that 528 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, a decrease from the previous 2 days when Iowa set one-day highs. 9 more people, are all of age 61 or older, died as a result of the disease, the Iowa Department of Public Health said. That brings the total number of corona-related deaths in Iowa to 184 since the disease was confirmed here on March 8th. On Friday, the state reported 739 positive cases, surpassed by Saturday's 757 new cases. Sunday's total, however, is based on fewer tests processed and reported during the period, 674 less than the day earlier. Despite the overall lower number, the ratio of positive tests out of the number of tests given each day actually increased to 5% Saturday to 6% on Sunday. Iowa's total number of positive viral cases stands at over 9,000 and negative tests at 44,000. The state said 1 in 59 Iowans have been tested. Linn County had 26 more positive cases on Sunday, and Polk County having far and away the most at 126, and Woodbury County, 38. Monroe County in the south central part of the state recorded its first coronavirus case, bringing to 91 the number of 99 counties where the virus has been found. Marshalltown in Marshall County and Waterloo in Black Hawk County and Sioux City in Woodbury County all have or are near meat processing facilities where large number of workers have tested positive. A worker at the JBS meatpacking plant in Wapello County tested positive on March 27th, though the facility never was closed. According to the state data, Polk County has now more than double the overall positive cases that Linn County has, which is almost 1,500. Black Hawk County is the second with 1,300, followed by Woodbury County, 1,100, Linn, Marsh, and Marshall County at 600, and Dallas at 537. Current hospitalization rates went up to 25 from Saturday's report. In the past 3 days, total hospitalizations have increased by an average of 10 patients per day, and this is in the whole state. However, the North Central and Southwest Iowa healthcare regions reported no new patients hospitalized because of the virus in the last 24 hours. The department has said 77% of the cases came from 22 counties where restrictions are harsher, ordered by Governor Kim Reynolds. Some restrictions on businesses in the other 77 counties began to ease on Friday. 9 deaths reported Sunday came from these counties: Black Hawk, Bremer, Dallas, Dubuque, Polk, Poweseek. 8 counties in the state have not recorded any coronaviruses. They are Adams, Decatur, Emmett, Freda, Ida, Lucas, Palo Alto, and Ringgold. Nebraska will open voting sites for primary despite concerns. In Lincoln, Nebraska is forging ahead with plans to hold the nation's first in-person election in more than a month, despite health concerns about the coronavirus pandemic and allegations that political motivations are fueling opposition to an all-male, M-A-I-L, approach. Bearing an unexpected change, Nebraska's primary will take place on May 12th, 5 weeks after Wisconsin held the last in-person balloting, when courts sided with Republican legislatures who pushed for that election to go forward. Republicans who hold all statewide offices and control the legislature have encouraged people to cast early absentee ballots. However, they argue state law requires polling sites to be open and that it's important for voters to have a choice for how they vote amid the health concerns. As Secretary of State Bob Evnen put it last month, "I don't think Nebraskans are going to stay away from the polls or not vote because of a microbe." Governor Pete Ricketts agreed, arguing that to do otherwise would disenfranchise voters who want to go to the polls, and noting that elections are previously held despite wars and pandemics. Others, however, question the motives behind the decision to hold the first statewide election since Wisconsin's much-criticized April 7th primary, and express doubt voting could safely take place. Wisconsin health officials say that more than 50 people who voted in person or worked the polls during the election have tested positive for COVID-19. The primary will decide a Democratic contest to pick a nominee to face Republican Representative Don Bacon in the Omaha's area's second congressional district, traditionally the only U.S. House seat in Nebraska where Democrats are competitive. Voters will also pick candidates in dozens of nonpartisan legislative races, which could help determine whether Republicans gain a supermajority in the legislature. Nebraska Democrats have asserted for weeks that Republican leaders don't want to hold the election via all mail because of concerns it would help Democrats, especially in the urban areas of Omaha and Lincoln. Republicans have dismissed such claims, but Democrats point to statements by President Donald Trump, who said you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again if all states switched to vote by mail. Jane Klieb, the chairwoman of the Nebraska Democratic Party, said Ricketts and the state GOP are concerned about any change that might boost Democratic turnout. "The only reason I can see the governor not doing it is for political reasons. The Republican playbook is always to suppress the vote. They know that when fewer people vote, they win." Senator Steve Lathrop, an Omaha Democrat, also criticized the decision to hold a polling place election, but said that with the primary only a couple weeks away, it's too late to change course now. "Given the seriousness of the pandemic, we should have turned this into a vote-by-mail election," Lathrop said. Officials plan to provide all poll workers with gloves, masks, hand sanitizer, and wipes, and the state has purchased 50 additional ballot drop-off boxes for counties. Still, the planned election concerns some public health officials who have watched what happened in Wisconsin, where public health departments reported at least 19 people who voted or worked at the polls tested positive for the coronavirus. "If you're asking me as a public health official whether this increases the risk of transmission, the answer is definitive. Yes," said Dr. Patrick Remington, director of the University of Wisconsin's Madison Preventative Medicine Residency Program. "That is a scientific fact, no matter how much protective equipment people wear." Still, even some voting rights advocates say they understand the difficulty of shifting to voting by mail. State Senator Adam Moorfield, a Democrat from Lincoln, said Nebraska does not have the mechanisms in place for vote by mail. And Weston Miller, Public Policy Director of Civic Nebraska, a group that advocates for statewide voting by mail, said the state does not have notification or tracking technology to let voters know whether their ballot has been sent, received, or counted. That could lead to ballots getting rejected without voters realizing it and undermining public confidence in voting by mail. "As a vote-by-mail advocate, the worst thing that could happen for our first vote-by-mail election is for it not to go well. I want it to go as smoothly as possible." More than 300,000 Nebraskans have requested absentee ballots, a level described as unprecedented. Given that, officials are predicting among the highest turnouts ever for a Nebraska primary. What's less clear is whether enough workers will show up to operate the voting sites. Nebraska has 1,240 precincts statewide, but some will be merged into one location to protect vulnerable residents, said Cindy Allen, a spokesperson for Evnen. For instance, a polling site normally located in an assisted living facility will likely get moved to another voting site with adequate space, such as a high school gymnasium. Allen said counties will decide. Janice Walker, age 73, of Lincoln, said she still plans to work at the polls, but hopes for low in-person turnout and that people use their heads and vote by mail. If we have a nice, slow, boring day, that will be good for me. It's not a good situation for workers, she said. It's time now for us to move to the obituaries. Today there are two. Kathy K. Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, of Turin, Iowa. Kathy Madsen, age 67, died Friday, May 1st. A service is scheduled for May 6th at 11 a.m. at the Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa. Social distancing must be followed. A burial at Ingman Cemetery in rural Moorhead, Iowa, will follow. Visitation times are May 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the chapel. Please no more than 10 people at a time. Lorraine R. Henning, H-E-N-N-I-N-G. Lorraine Henning of Mobile, Iowa, age 92, died on Saturday, May 2nd. A private funeral service due to COVID-19 will be on May 6th at 10:30 a.m. at the Christie Smith Funeral Homes in Morningside Chapel. A burial will be at the Gilman Township Cemetery in Ashton, Iowa. Okay, our next article, even though this is a national article, I think it's important to read. It's about the coronavirus, Glimmer of Hope from Remdesivir. A drug seems to treat COVID-19. Here's what might come next. News that an experimental drug seems to be the first effective treatment for the new coronavirus has unleashed a flurry of interest and a clamor to know how soon it might be available. Talk turned to how quickly the federal FDA might act on Gilead Sciences' Remdesivir after preliminary results from a major study found that it shortened the recovery time by an average of 4 days for people who were hospitalized with COVID-19. On Friday, as expected, the FDA okayed emergency use of the drug. We now have a drug that you have proven can actually work on the virus, the National Institutes of Health Dr. Anthony Fauci told the Associated Press. Will it be an overwhelming cure? No, of course not, Fauci said. But with its use, you will free up hospital beds, you will take less stress on the healthcare system. When independent experts monitoring the study called with the news that the drug was working, Dr. Andre Khalil of the University of Nebraska said he was almost speechless with joy. Here are some questions about the results and the next steps. How much does the drug help? Remdesivir reduced the time patients were in the hospital by 31%, from 15 days down to 11 days. Preliminary results of the study found. The drug also may reduce deaths, although it is not certain from the partial results revealed so far. About 8% of those on the drug died versus 11.6% of the comparison group, but the difference is not large enough for scientists to say for sure that the drug was the reason. How about folks with milder illness? Remdesivir so far has only been tested in people with moderate to severe illness who were hospitalized and received it through an IV. Even among those in the study, there was a very big span of illness, from people just needing a little extra oxygen to those requiring breathing machines, said Dr. Elizabeth Homan, who enrolled 49 patients in the study at the Massachusetts General Hospital. We need more information to see how best to use it going forward and which type of patients get the most benefit. Question, will it be available? When will it be available and for whom? The FDA has made it immediately available through an emergency use authorization, which speeds experimental drugs, tests, and other medical products to patients during public health crises. Under the authorization, the agency waived the usually vigorous standards necessary for drug approval. The FDA also did that for hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug that President Donald Trump touted for COVID-19, despite no clear evidence that it works. Fauci had predicted the drug would get approval very quickly, and he had personally spoken with FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn about it. Question, how much is there and what will it cost? Gilead has or is close to having 140,000 treatment courses now, and they will be donated, Chairman Daniel O'Day said. The company aims to have made a total of 500,000 treatment courses by October and more than 1 million by December. Gilead's own testing suggests that 5 days of treatment are as good as 10, so the estimates of how many people can be treated with the available supply likely can be doubled, he added. Question, how might having a treatment affect the impact of the pandemic? Having to spend less time in the hospital reduces the risk patients will develop complications, such as other infections, or spread the virus to healthcare workers. Those benefits extend not just to the patients who receive the drug, but to others as well, said Dr. Anissa Mehta, who enrolled 103 patients at Emory and other Atlanta hospitals. We create more availability in our hospitals, and we can take care of more patients with other medical problems, including those who have been forced to delay surgeries for cancer, bad hearts, and other maladies. Question, what about other drugs in testing? Remdesivir will become the standard of care, and any other potential treatments will now have to be tested against it or in combination with it, Fauci said. He recalled AZT, the first drug shown to help people with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. That drug by itself proved not terribly strong, but it led to a host of others being developed, and the notion of combination treatments that are used now for HIV, tuberculosis, and other diseases. Dr. Max Parmore, director of the clinical trial unit at the University of College London, said it was likely remdesivir would need to be combined with other treatments to more successfully treat COVID-19. The study suggests remdesivir could be the backbone of treatment, but other drugs may be needed, he said. Will having a treatment cause people to ease up on social distancing? I hope not, said Dr. Fauci. This is not a knockout punch. This is not a cure. These are from the Wall Street Journal, the weekend edition. The title of this is The U.S. Consumer is Nesting. Will that last? And there's a picture of Pamela and Michael Longo with their two children and how they are changing their household habits. Clorox Company, Amazon.com Inc., and Domino's Pizza can't ramp up fast enough to meet demand for cleaning products, home deliveries, and snack food. More people are streaming videos from Netflix and music from Spotify. Shares of Peloton Interactive have soared as fitness buffs scrap their gym memberships. Meanwhile, companies that rely on people traveling, being together, or venturing out in public are crashing. Restaurant chain Cheesecake Factory, Inc. furloughed most of its workers. Air carrier Delta Airlines and retail J. Crew are slashing costs, scrambling for loans, and restructuring as they are sustaining massive losses. The big question is how many of these new habits will endure more permanently as the country inches back to something resembling normal life? The answer will have far-reaching implications for industries from food and fashion to travel and technology, forcing companies to rework supply chains, product lineups, and relationships with retailers. The three-month period we are going through is equating to 3 years of consumer changes wrapped up in one quarter,
David Gibbs, the CEO of Taco Bell parent Yum Brands, said this week. Not everyone agrees. Several retailers' spending slowed in April after consumers stockpiled in March. We largely expect consumers to eventually return to previous habits as they slowly exit confinement and cautiously settle into a new normal, PepsiCo CEO Raymond LaGuardia said. Taking the Longos, the couple that lives in Valhalla, New York, a small-time town 30 miles north of Manhattan, Pamela Longo, an assistant principal and mother of two, was not a fan of home workouts. Her husband, Michael Longo, who owns a financial planning firm, long wanted to work once a week from home, but always ended up in the office. 7 weeks after they were forced into their suburban New York home by coronavirus, Pamela has started riding a Peloton bike in the basement that allows users to join virtual spin classes. She's also added online workout classes, finding the fitness combination far more efficient and motivational than she anticipated. I never would have predicted this, she said. Michael has discovered he has more family time without a twice daily 30-minute commute, and he's hashing out plans to spend as little as 3 days a week at the office. This is a horrible thing that has happened, but there is some good coming out of it, he said. Some other changes may be more temporary. For instance, Pamela says she has enjoyed learning new time-consuming recipes, including an Italian pasta dish on a recent night, but will revert to simpler dishes once she returns to work. To get inside the minds of consumers like the Longos, corporations are marshaling their expertise and resources in hopes of getting ahead of changing needs and preferences. Consumer product giant Procter & Gamble, for example, knows that people are not only buying more Tide laundry detergent, but they are also doing more loads of laundry at home because it follows digital monitors installed inside some consumers' washing machines to show how often they run loads. Legions of analysts and consultants are taking surveys, combing sales data, and building models to try to gauge what demand is going to be and where it's going to be. More subtle microtrends are emerging as well. Retailers report selling a higher ratio of shirts to pants as people dress for video calls. Jigsaw puzzles are selling out. Post-it notes are falling out of favor amid empty offices. Pricey coffee is getting a boost as cafe lovers are forced to brew at home. A lot of people are focused on what the 80% of consumers will feel like in the new normal. Are they going to go out and eat or go to a movie? It's really about the remaining 20%, because most businesses cannot operate on 80% of demand. They will need a major overhaul. The extent of how customers change their behaviors hinges a lot on how families lived before the crisis. Aaron Russell and Travis Hoag, 38-year-old parents of 4-year-old twins in Holt, Michigan, have changed much about their daily routines, but little about how they spend their money. The family rarely dined out, vacationed, or went to movies before the pandemic, so they are not missing those outings. Aaron is an architectural designer for a national insurer, and Travis, a grounds mechanic for the state of Michigan in nearby Lansing. Their children attended preschool, and Travis's mother cared for them the 2 days a week they were not in school. The preschool is closed, and Travis's mom is at high risk of contracting coronavirus. Aaron now works full-time from home while Travis is furloughed, leaving him caring for the kids most of the time. Travis is still adjusting to being the main caregiver, but the couple says the setup is working overall. Aaron's main gripe is that she has to drink coffee at home. A daily drinker of either Starbucks or Dunkin' Coffee, she has taken up making whipped coffee and getting nicer Keurig options to supplement what she calls old man or drip coffee at home. It's a tolerable substitute, but it's not Starbucks, she said. The pandemic has altered another consumer paradigm. One of the most difficult parts of selling a product is getting consumers to actually try it. Companies go to lengths to get their brand in the hands of shoppers, giving away free products and services in hopes that exposure will convince them to make a switch. We've been forced to try a lot of new things. The longer we are forced to change our habits, the longer we may adapt them. It's not just, yeah, it's a habit. I might have to accept a change because I can't afford to go back. I might also just like something else more. One change Pamela Longo made was to spring for a $100 a year subscription to Beachbody online fitness classes, which she had never before considered and plans to stick with the program. The Longos expect their priorities will remain changed, if not for good, for some time beyond the current crisis. The family had planned a week-long trip to Disney World in Florida in April. Even if the theme park opens and stay-at-home orders are lifted, Michael Longo said the family will not be in a big public space or on an airplane until at least next year. Instead, they hope to get in a visit to Cape Cod or the Hamptons this summer where they can drive and avoid large crowds. So to supplement that, there's a chart here that shows home confinement has benefited makers of products from cleaning supplies to toys, where sectors like airlines and restaurants were hit hard. Here's a lineup of the winners. Here's the first quarter change from the previous year. The jump in Clorox's U.S. cleaning unit sales has increased 32%. Amazon sales jumped 26%. Hasbro gaming retail sales increased 25%, and Netflix streaming memberships has risen 23%, and this is in the first quarter. The losers, 95% drop in Delta's U.S. passenger volumes, 22% decline in Estee Lauder makeup sales, and the home and outdoor sales at Newell's has reduced 13%, and Starbucks same store sales has gone down 10%. The coronavirus has affected people in some positively and some negatively. From the Wall Street Journal, patchwork of state rules reveal little consensus on reopening. In Oklahoma, hair salons began welcoming back clients this past week. Next door in Kansas, they remain empty. In Orlando, Florida, retail stores can open to customers again on Monday. But in Miami, they must stay closed. In the Texas capital, Austin, one landmark restaurant resumed serving dine-in customers on Friday, and another down the street is closed. After more than a month under lockdown as an attempt to slow the spread of the new coronavirus that has already killed more than 64,000 Americans, the nation is beginning to open back up. At least 30 states have begun allowing some businesses to operate or announced plans to do so in May. But unlike the shutdown, which most public health experts and economists agreed was necessary to avoid millions more potential deaths and an even more dire economic catastrophe, the reopening of America is happening with little consensus on how it should proceed. State and local officials, and in some cases, corporate executives and small business owners, are drawing their own conclusions about how to balance medical and economic risks. While some are eagerly lifting restrictions, others are warning residents and customers that any significant relaxation of social distancing rules remains weeks away. Their decisions will add up to an unprecedented national experience that will determine the health of 328 million people and a $22 trillion economy. There's really no right answer here, unfortunately, said Crystal Watkin, a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. There are definitely different appetites for risk. The Trump administration has introduced broad voluntary guidelines for states to begin reopening their economies. The three-phased approach suggests that states should meet certain criteria, including a decline in cases for 14 days before some businesses could begin reopening. You're going to call your own shots, President Trump told the governors over video conference. The result is a hodgepodge of policies with no consistent connection between state plans for reopening and the number of coronavirus infections, deaths, or health data. The only pattern appears to be a political one. Conservative states are generally opening more quickly than liberal ones. In Texas, the pressure to reopen the economy has been greater than almost anywhere else. Fellow Republicans denounced Governor Greg Abbott for moving too slowly to reopen the state, and some small businesses have openly flouted the restrictions. Shelley Luther, the owner of Salon a la Mode in Dallas, began operations February 24th and stayed open despite a cease and desist letter from local officials and a threat of a misdemeanor charge and temporary restraining order. She said Thursday that her hairstylists were trained in keeping things sanitary. Only one of her 19 stylists are working. Only three of her 19 stylists are working. The rest fear having their license revoked. This past week, Governor Abbott said restaurants, retail stores, theaters, and malls would also be allowed to resume operations Friday at 25% capacity. Bars, salons, and barbershops and gyms will have to wait. Many restaurants in the state remained closed. However, as they are unable to operate profitably with just a handful of customers at a time. One did open, and that was Texas Chili Parlor, an Austin institution a block from the Capitol. Tables are 10 feet apart. Homemade hand sanitizer is set at the entrance. Every employee given a thermometer to check their temperature before starting work. The owner had been paying his workers during the shutdown, though only three at a time were working to fulfill takeout orders. After losing an estimated $100,000, he said 25% capacity in seating is better than nothing. Scientists have been cautious, however, noting that Texas has tested just over 1% of their population, one of the lowest rates in the country. Ideally, scientists say states that reopen should have the capacity to test anyone with symptoms. You can open up anytime you want. The question is, can you stay open? If you open and then have to shut back down at the end of June or July, that's a mess. Some state officials want the CDC to provide more guidelines on whether to reopen or how to reopen. Instead, states are relying on random public health experts and using coronavirus infection trackers run by private institutions. That brings us to the end of the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, which is Monday, May 4th. And as they say in the Star Wars world, may the 4th be with you. Have a great day. Enjoy the week and be safe and keep healthy. Thanks for joining me.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. An article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherence to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843-44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. The leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the Village Council of Brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colonies Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the Old Order in 1932, the number of the Society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.